You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources is investigating PFAS contamination. That's a class of toxic chemicals that don't break down in the environment at about 100 sites around the state. But the DNR's authority to do anything about the contamination took a hit this week when a Waukesha County judge's ruling denied the department's authority to force businesses to clean up the chemicals. The problem, the judge says, is there isn't a state statute about them, at least not yet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are PFAS, sometimes called forever chemicals, a problem in your community where you live? If your water has PFAS contamination, is anything going on to try to fix it? How has it affected your town, your city, your family? Do you have thoughts or questions about the ruling this week from that Waukesha County judge? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll start out with a look at the experience of one Wisconsin city dealing with the problem. Katie Rosenberg is the mayor of the city of Wausau. Mayor Rosenberg, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
How big a problem do you have in Wausau with PFAS?
So I think our problem is a little bit exacerbated by the lack of legislation we have both federally and statewide. Our problem is we're about between 20 parts per trillion and maybe 40 parts per trillion in some wells. And of course we wanna be lower than that because we heard from the DHS and the DNR that we shouldn't have that in our water system. So it's complicated, we found out. And then of course the DNR had their special session to talk about it. We've been talking to the EPA, but the DHS still has their health advisory. So I would say it's a problem. We're trying not to panic and we don't want people to panic. Mm-hmm. And we're working methodically to get it removed from our system once we have our new drinking water facility online. But in the meantime, we're bringing in several different kinds of short-term fixes.
Yeah, what are some of those short-term fixes? We've heard around the state everything from this community is bringing in bottled water to, well, we're just shutting down this one well and that is going to take care of it for now. What kind of things are you doing?
Yeah, so we looked at the well solution because we have one well that seems a little bit hotter than the others, but that won't work with us because there's a complicating factor with that well being a Superfund site. So we brought in short-term bottled water, and then we also ordered tons of pitchers from a company that filters out the PFAS in the water. So we're doing that. We're also working on bench testing and pilot testing some resins and different kinds of activated carbon to see how it's doing. And we have some promising results for maybe a near-term solution at our current facility. And we're also hoping to inform the solution to our brand new facility that will open later this summer.
There are a lot of different sources, different uses for these chemicals around the state. What do you know about the origins of the PFAS in the Wausau area?
Right. So we don't have exactly a handle on where that is. You know, we'll work with the DNR to identify that responsible party. But like a lot of cities in Wisconsin, we have heritage that's industrial along that Wisconsin River. So we're anticipating some of that to come from industry. And then, you know, it's everywhere. It is everywhere from what gets spread on farm fields to your frying pans, everything. So we're trying to get as much out of it as we can, but it's a challenge when you just have this ubiquitous chemical.
What would you like to see either at the state or the federal level when it comes to guidelines and maybe help with cleanup?
Oh, my goodness. First of all, very clear guidelines will be critical for us and for any municipality dealing with this. So right now what we have is we have advisories from both the DNR and the Environmental Protection Agency, which are great. But it's not regulatory standards. So we're struggling with now we have to decide where we want to be as a city when it comes to this standard. So we know that the Department of Health Services says that it's a hazard. We shouldn't have it in our water. And that's what we're going with right now. We would like to get below 20 parts per trillion, as close to zero as we can. You know, we've talked about it at our meetings. The council seems decisive in that we want to be as far below 20 parts per trillion as we can, just because we want to get rid of that health hazard in the water. But, you know, we obviously want to have a more cohesive answer for our neighbors and our entire state and nation. We care about people.
There are lots of mayors in the state and city managers and county executives, and the list goes on, dealing with some version of this problem. Are you in contact with your peers around the state to try to share solutions?
Oh, yes, we are. So one of the cool things about Wausau being right here in Marathon County is that we have pretty good relationships with our surrounding municipalities. So once we actually tested after the DNR asked us to, because Rib Mountain, our neighboring municipality, tested, and they had a pretty hot well. So we tested, and then other municipalities also tested, and we're all kind of getting similar results. Some are a little more PFAS in the water than others. But we've been talking about what does a regional approach look like? And we've asked some questions of the EPA, and they're interested in helping us figure out what that regional approach looks like. And obviously, we have things like the bipartisan infrastructure bill and our ARPA funding that can help fund these solutions. And so we can only be more effective together. So we're talking about this at our Metropolitan Planning Organization because, water is infrastructure too.
Mayor Rosenberg, thanks for joining us today.
Of course, thank you for having me.
Katie Rosenberg is the mayor of Wausau. She joined us for a look at PFAS contamination and efforts to solve the problem in her community. Now we turn to wider issues of regulation of these chemicals and the law here in Wisconsin. David Strifling is a professor and director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me again.
Well, we've got this ruling from a judge that says, hey, DNR, you can't regulate this chemical. You can't mandate cleanup in part. What went into this ruling?
Well, I think this is another chapter in the ongoing debate at the national and state levels about the role of agencies. Do we trust them as experts, or are they unelected bureaucrats who have too much power? That's sort of the division here. How much discretion should DNR have? So we've talked previously about DNR's efforts to set standards for PFAS in surface water and groundwater and drinking water. This one's a little different. We're talking now about DNR's authority to require cleanup or remediation of PFAS that are already in the environment when that release was caused by some particular entity. And that's what the decision yesterday or this week, I should say, was all about.
We heard from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. They're a group that backed a local business person who was challenging DNR regulation and requirement of cleanup of PFAS. The gist they had was like, there's no official state mandate on this. There's no guide. There's a recommended guideline, but nothing else. If we apply that kind of standard to enforcement actions for the DNR, it really is a big question mark for businesses. What do you think of that argument?
Right. So the spills law essentially says that anyone who owns or controls, quote unquote, hazardous substances have to notify DNR of any release of that substance and also take actions necessary to restore the environment. Now, the issue is that hazardous substances are pretty broadly defined as essentially anything that causes harm to human health or the environment. So DNR has a lot of discretion or had a lot of discretion in determining what fits that definition. Now, yesterday's ruling said there's no list of hazardous substances, at least not one that's publicly available, not one in the statute and not one in the regulation. So the court says that DNR has to create one, has to go through the rulemaking process. And as we've seen with the standard setting process, that can take years. So the concern is, from a societal perspective, I think, going beyond DNR's perspective or the business perspective, that we're not going to see these sites being cleaned up. We want a fair process for sure, but we want the sites to be cleaned up.
Do we have measures in place that would allow the DNR to stop someone who's currently releasing these chemicals into the environment?
Well, I think it's questionable. From DNR's perspective, this is a case, we have a saying in the law that bad facts make bad law. And I'm sure that's what DNR is thinking about this case, that, the plaintiff, Leather Rich, who was backed by WMC, had a cleanup plan in place. And DNR apparently changed the cleanup requirements midstream to require a PFAS remediation as well. And the remediation plan that was there at the beginning was no longer approved by the DNR. And the court had a big problem with that, said that this pulls the rug out from under the responsible party and it's a violation of due process. Part of the issue here too is the court just made an oral ruling from the bench, didn't prepare anything in writing. So we're going to have to really wait and see the transcript before we decide what it means for, say, ongoing cleanups. But I do think that is a concern if I were at the DNR that, you know, especially those ongoing cleanups that are focused on PFAS and potentially other substances as well are thrown into question by this ruling. And certainly your hypothetical question about somebody who's releasing PFAS now would fall into that same category. I think DNR's authority is thrown into question by this ruling.
We're talking to David Strifling, director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. We're looking at the DNR's ability to regulate PFAS, the so-called forever chemicals, after a ruling this week from a Waukesha County judge appears to limit that power. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much authority do you think the DNR should have to require cleanup of this particular pollutant and to prevent it from being released into the environment? Do you want to see that power being kept in check as it is under this court ruling? What questions do you have about Wisconsin's spills law, a key part of the story here? And is this a problem in your own community, in your local water? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with David Strifling, director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School, looking at the DNR and its authority to regulate contamination cleanup, specifically around PFAS, after a court ruling says that isn't specified in current rules and current laws, so you can't necessarily require cleanup. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about this, your experiences if this is an issue in your own community. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Shane is with us in Appleton. Shane, hi.
Hello, good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Shane?
Well, I guess I don't quite understand how this is a question of, you know, somebody has to be responsible for this contamination, and there needs to be some oversight. I just don't understand how this is even a question.
Shane, thanks for the call. David, why, we've talked about this a little, why is this a question?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. Somebody has to be responsible, and in some cases, we know who the entity is who's responsible for the pollution. But the question is, the legal question anyway, is what's the process by which we have to tell that person what to do? What is the standard by which that responsible party has to clean up the environment? And that's what the plaintiffs were arguing in the court case, that this is, the way it's set up now, just sort of unlimited discretion on the part of DNR. And the court agreed in this case that that's a violation of the responsible party's due process. So, you know, I've read a lot of headlines that say DNR doesn't have the ability anymore to regulate PFAS. I don't think that's quite what the court was saying. DNR still has the authority to regulate PFAS, the court said. It's just got to go through the right process to do that. And, you know, we can certainly disagree about whether the length of time that it takes to go through that process is reasonable. But I think that's what the court was driving at in its ruling.
Shane, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. David, Shane was talking about a situation where we know who was responsible for this particular PFAS problem. How about, as we were talking to the mayor of Wausau earlier, what if we don't know? We know there were five industries that probably at some point released these chemicals in the environment. We can't point toward this well and say, ah, Company A's emissions were the problem here. Even supposing DNR gets these rules in place, how hard does that make enforcement and trying to get somebody to be accountable for cleanup?
That certainly compounds the issue when you have a causation question and you can't even prove that one entity caused the spill. That only makes DNR's job harder. You know, what we're talking about now really in these cases that have been in front of the courts, whether it's Johnson Controls or Leather Rich, we know the entity who's responsible. It's just the cleanup standard. That's the question. If we don't even know that first part of the equation, that certainly makes DNR's job a lot harder, and there's no easy answer to that. And we see it a lot in environmental cases, toxic torts. The causation question is really difficult.
We are talking about PFAS pollution in Wisconsin, the DNR's authority to regulated to require cleanup that took a hit, at least for now, in a court ruling. Still time for your calls with questions, your thoughts, your comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, the standards for PFAS. Now, the last I saw, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, this is at the federal level, says their guidelines, 70 parts per million. Wisconsin's Health Department, 70 parts per trillion. The Department of Health Services in Wisconsin saying 20 parts per trillion. They're very different numbers. They're both guidelines, not mandates. Does that make the regulation here more difficult?
Well, this is where DNR has to go through the standard setting process. And so that's a different question from this court decision in Waukesha County this week that has to do with the cleanup process once they're already in the environment. So yeah, DNR has to go through that standard setting process that could take, 30 months, 36 months. And that culminated in the February hearing before the Natural Resources Board where, some of the standards were approved, some aren't. And even then in Wisconsin, you've still got to get legislative approval for some of these rules. So it's a lengthy process. And this would be, I can say with some confidence, a lot easier if we had federal standards in place. And I think the Biden administration and the Biden EPA is working toward that goal, but it isn't there yet. And so what we're seeing is a lot of states moving forward, kind of piecemeal without the guidance of a federal standard in place. And that's certainly slowing things down here.
Which is likely to happen faster, a set of federal standards or going through this rulesmaking process in Wisconsin?
It's hard to say, and it depends on, that would vary on a state-by-state basis. The process in Wisconsin is a little bit longer than in some other states, but what we're seeing is the states are moving faster, at least at this point, that the states are putting their own regulations in place before we see anything on the federal level. The federal process isn't that short either. The federal EPA still has to go through a notice and comment rulemaking process that can take years on its own, so it's a little bit of a horse apiece, but we can only wish that EPA would have gotten an earlier start on all this.
So if the DNR wants a rule in place, and supposing that key lawmakers are willing to give their part of their approval to it, like what is the next step for that? What kind of things would have to happen now to start that clock, start that timeline?
So I think, if I were at DNR, a few things to do here. One is, again, what we have from the court is an oral ruling. We would need a transcript right away to prepare to really analyze what the court's decision is and what the basis for it is. Then, and DNR has already done this, it will file a motion to stay the ruling, and the parties are going to brief that, and that will be decided in June. That means that the ruling would be put on pause while it's appealed, which I also expect will happen here in some form, that DNR will appeal this ruling. But while all that is going on in the legal track, the legal side, I think DNR also will begin preparing a list of some sort of the hazardous substances that it will consider to be hazardous substances under the spills law, for the context of the spills law. Because another thing about all of this that I think is being missed is we're not just talking about PFAS here. We're talking more broadly about DNR's authority to define what are hazardous substances under the spills law. So, is DNR going to have to go through a lengthy rulemaking for every new emerging contaminant that comes down the pike or for substances that it previously has enforced under the spills law, like manure spreading and even milk dumping from dairies, things that we don't normally consider ultra hazardous substances or even hazardous substances in some cases? All that is called into play, I think, by the court's ruling here. So, DNR has to start thinking about if this doesn't go its way, what are we going to do to get some kind of a list in place and start a rulemaking process that ultimately is going to take us through a lengthy time period that starts with a scope statement approved by the Natural Resources Board, gets public comment and public hearing, finally gets approved by the Natural Resources Board, and then goes back to the legislature. So, I think DNR's got to be moving forward on a couple of tracks here. One is an appeal of the judge's ruling, but another is if that ruling stands, what do we do next? And that probably starts with the preparation of a list.
if I own, say, a company that's currently under a cleanup agreement for PFAS, or as you say, a lot of different stuff, does this ruling for now, unless it stayed, open the door for me to go back and say, hang on, under this precedent, I don't need to do this?
Well, I think it opens a window. And again, in this case, it was a little bit unusual in that DNR changed course in the middle of the cleanup. So I think, you know, depending on the substance and how the process has gone, it could open a door. It doesn't necessarily do that. But I would be surprised if the company's attorneys aren't undertaking the kind of review that you just sketched out as we speak.
In our last few moments, what are you watching for next on this story, David?
Well, I think we've got to see what happens next from a DNR's point of view. You know, are they going to appeal? I certainly would expect that. Is the court going to grant a stay of the ruling, which would, again, put things on pause while an appeal goes forward? And what does DNR say publicly about, you know, the other possibility that, you know, this ruling stands, and what DNR will do next if it remains in place?
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
David Strifling is director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University Law School. We talked with him about PFAS and the Wisconsin DNR's ability to regulate PFAS contamination cleanup. As we've heard, a new wrinkle on that question coming out of a court in Wisconsin this week. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, inflation numbers stayed on the high side in the latest reports. Can the Federal Reserve tackle that problem without risking a recession? An economist breaks down the quest to slow down inflation, and you can join in with your questions, your comments, maybe your experiences in dealing with inflation yourself. Let us know if you have a question right now. You can email centraltime@wpr.org. Plus, we'll meet a Milwaukee artist who uses water to create unique art that tells the story of Black history. Those stories and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, an endocrinologist explains the link between COVID and a potential increased risk of developing diabetes. Plus, we'll look at an insulin price cap passed by the U.S. House last month, still waiting for action in the Senate. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wausau's mayor tells us about the city's latest efforts to deal with toxic so-called forever chemicals in drinking water. And we check out a recent court ruling that could limit the state DNR's ability to act on those chemicals under Wisconsin's spills law. Now, spaghetti, vermicelli, bucatini, lo mein, there's a wide, wide world of noodles out there. Our guests today are two card-carrying members of the Noodle Fan Club, and they say whether you want an elaborate, tasty dish to share or just a quick and yummy dinner, noodles are there for you. It's Food Friday, and we're talking about noodles and pasta, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite kind of noodle to cook with or eat? Your favorite recipe? Do you like them in soup, with a sauce, straight up with butter? Have you ever made your own noodles, your own pasta? How'd it go? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mike and Stephanie Lee are the creators of the I Am a Food blog. Their new cookbook is That Noodle Life: Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpy. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how's it going, Rob?
Good. And Stephanie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Stephanie, can you start out by telling us just about your love for noodles?
I love noodles. I think I've always loved noodles. They've been one of my favorite foods ever since I was a little kid. And it was just such an amazing experience to be able to write a book about, you know, a food that most of the world has eaten before.
And Mike, there are so many cultures that eat noodles and so many kinds of noodles within each of those food traditions. How did you try to narrow it down and fit what you could into just one book?
Well, we couldn't, actually. We had twice, or I think maybe even three times as many recipes, and our editor was just after us. He's like, the book is too long, guys. You can't have this. And over time, you know, we whittled it down, but this is definitely not all we wanted to put in.
Now, Stephanie, I've never made my own noodles, you know, and I'm okay with that, but I always get the sense like, oh, I'm really missing out. It'd be way better if I made my own noodles. You write in the book, not necessarily. We can do pretty well with store-bought stuff.
That's absolutely true. Like, it's super fun to make your own pasta, but, like, let's face it, it's really easy to go out and buy high-quality bronze extruded pasta. So when you get, like, dried pasta from the store, like, those people that are making it are obviously, like, experts. So, you know, they know what they're doing. And also, when you cook dried pasta, it absorbs the sauce more, so you actually get more flavor in the noodles. Whereas when you're cooking fresh noodles, sometimes, you know, if you're not really experienced, they can fall apart in the sauce. So, you know, store-bought's great too.
And Mike, one tip, and I've heard this from a past Food Friday guest, Lydia Bastianich, if you're buying dry stuff, it should be rough, not smooth. Why is that?
The rough edges and the rough surfaces pick up the sauce better, whereas, you know, with the smooth pastas, it's actually the cheaper kind of pastas because the tooling is cheaper to make. The sauce slides right off of it, and you're not really getting anything there. You know, it's just basically eating plain wheat, and then you're eating sauce afterwards.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about noodles with Stephanie Lee and Mike Lee. They have a new cookbook out. It's called That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of noodles? What kind? How do you like to eat them? What kind of restaurants do you like to go to for noodle dishes? Do you have questions about cooking them right? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stephanie, I thought this was interesting, especially with those dry store-bought noodles, saucing the noodles. Can you talk about, you know, the cooking time on that dry pasta if we're going to be cooking it in then with a sauce?
Yeah, so we recommend that you cook it a little bit shy of what they suggest on the package so that you can finish your noodles in the sauce so that when you're cooking it at the end, the sauce is really soaking into the pasta, so you get like a complete bite of sauce. So you get a complete bite of pasta-infused sauce. Oh, no, wait, sauce-infused pasta.
Either way works for me. I'm good with both.
That's right.
And Mike, using some of our pasta water in the final sauce, what does that do for us?
It emulsifies the sauce. Basically, the starch in the pasta goes into the water, and then when you put that water back into the sauce, it makes the sauce thicker and glossier.
Now, you've shared a few recipes with us. We've got them up online at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you've got some, you know, serious project type recipes. And you've got a whole, and I love this, a whole chapter on kind of quick and easy recipes. Let's start with one of those, Stephanie. This one sounds great. Spicy sesame chili oil noodles. Can you tell us a little bit about this recipe?
It's kind of like a take on sesame noodles that you get from takeout, yeah. But instead, mostly those are made with like peanut butter. So this is a bit more traditional, made with Chinese sesame paste. And then we have like some chili oil and there's some Chinese black vinegar, which these are ingredients that like are easily found online. But we also included some substitutions if you need them. So you can use stuff like tahini or just regular balsamic vinegar, and it's just a spicy, nutty, savory, tangy, like really savory noodle dish that you'll want to eat more and more of.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in La Crosse. John, hi.
Hi. I just thought I'd comment on my favorite noodles are those made by Hua Ki in Madison. A wonderful northern Chinese noodles made from rice, made from wheat. And they're made in his business. Very good. Another thing, a comment, I wonder if you people on our show here have ever made your noodles by hand, like the Uyghurs do when they stretch it from their two hands repeatedly over and over and over until they finally get some, you know, noodles rather than a big mass of dough.
John, thanks for the call. Before I let you go, I think I got some bad news for you, pal. Wok, he closed a while back. They have really good, noodles though. I'm right there with you, John. Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sorry to break the tidings to you. Yeah. But John, thank you for calling in. That hand stretched noodles, Mike, is that something? I feel like I've seen video of that. Is that something you've worked on or seen in action?
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways to do it, right? Like, there's hand pulled noodles, which we actually have in a book, right, where you're just kind of slapping them against the table and they get longer and longer and longer. And then there's also hand, I think Stephanie can fill me in here better, but basically, like, you know, handmade noodles where, like, as you pull them, they turn into noodles. And, like, you know, first you get two and then you get four and then eventually you get like 100,000 noodles. Is that what you're thinking of?
That's right. Yeah. There are two kinds of Chinese noodles like that. Like, yeah, they're both made with wheat, like the caller said. And like one, you can, we have one recipe in the book where you can just pull them and they're really easy to make because you're just making one giant noodle. And there's another one where it's a bit more complicated where you kind of make ropes upon ropes of noodles and then you keep pulling them. But either way, hand-pulled Chinese noodles are definitely really, really delicious. And we do have a recipe for that in the book.
Now, if I wanted to make a Chinese noodle dish at home, the pasta I know comes in different sort of forms and formats than maybe that bag, of, that box of spaghetti or whatever. What should we look for, Stephanie, in the stores as we're buying noodles for our sesame noodles or other Asian-style dishes? And I know, again, there's a lot of variety there.
Yeah. Well, for the sesame noodles, you can actually just use any noodle you like. Like, we have definitely eaten that sauce with spaghetti before. But if you're looking for, like, a Chinese noodle, you can just go for a straight-up wheat noodle, and they just call them wheat noodles. Or if you go to the refrigerator section, they have these noodles called lo mein noodles, and those are already cooked. And, yeah, or you can even use instant noodle packets and just take the sauce packet out and just use the instant noodles, too. That works great.
Now, moving back to Italy, Mike, I understand you're a big fan of lasagna. Can you tell us what grabs you about? This is the big baked pasta dish there.
It is. And, you know, like, there's, I mean, everyone loves lasagna, so it's not
to go wrong.
To
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We love it, though, because, you know, like, when we were writing the noodle book, we're like, what is a noodle? And we were discussing the pros and cons of all the different kinds of noodles and filled noodles and things like that. And we realized, you know, lasagna is like just the world's largest noodle that literally anyone eats. So big that it fills a pan. And, you know, that's just something that we just really love to celebrate.
We're talking to Mike and Stephanie Lee about their new cookbook. It's called That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the best noodle dish you've ever had anywhere? Homemade, restaurant made, traveling, or whatever? Do you have a favorite noodle-related comfort food dish that you go back to again and again? Or do you have questions for our guest about anything noodle cooking related? They probably have an answer for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Check out WPR.org/Food Friday for a few recipes from Stephanie and Mike. We've talked about one of them. We'll get into one or two more as we go on. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about noodles, pasta, and the new cookbook, That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpy. Authors Mike and Stephanie Lee stay with us, and you can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your noodle favorites, your noodle questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go back to your calls now. Bruce is with us in Madison. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I have a question on taste. I've had, just like many people, different brands of pasta, and I've looked at the ingredients on the boxes, and they look identical, but yet the different brands of pasta taste different. Some taste a lot worse than others. Some taste a lot better. I read that it might be because some manufacturers rush the drying time. I had a question on why is that?
That's a noodle mystery, Bruce. Thanks. Stephanie, do you have a thought about that?
Even though the ingredients might be the same, the ratios or the proportions that the makers are making it with are probably different. So, you know, it's a question that, like, pasta is made, well, it can be made with just water and wheat, but it can also be made with eggs, but then you get all different kinds of ratios within that. And also it does have to do with the drying time as well. And also the machinery that they use to extrude it. So yeah, that's why they all taste different. And also the salt content too.
Thanks a lot for that call.
And I just want to jump in there. Oh, I just wanted to say the reason that the manufacturers rush the drying time is because of real estate. And so the longer the drying time, the more room they need at the factory. That's why the slow dried pastas tend to cost a lot more money.
Interesting. Okay, thanks a lot for that call. I want to check out another recipe you shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Bun Bo Wei. You say it's kind of like a Vietnamese pho soup, but even more fun in some ways. Mike, do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, it's a lot more fun because, you know, pho is kind of like a universally loved because it's not that neutral. It's a very neutral tasting soup, whereas BBH is what we call it because it's easier to say. It's spicy and it's flavorful. It explodes in your mouth and it's just like a lot of fun to eat. And like there's a lot of meats that you can eat it with. And there's a, you know, it's a thick, chewy noodle, not like quite as tender as pho. And it's just like by far the better version. You know, like if you ever had like a really good pasta and then you go back to like marinara, that's kind of like how it feels.
That is at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Hayward. Rick, hi.
Good afternoon. So I want to talk about the power of the noodle. I've been aggressively trying to get hired at a high-volume Italian restaurant with no success. I called them a number of times. I just couldn't get it done. So I made a pan of stuffed rigatoni with homemade tomato sauce and Italian sausage, and the owner called me today, and I start next week.
Awesome, so Rick.
Amazing.
Buying them lunch. Yeah, they don't need my resume. They just needed my stuffed rigatoni.
You could drop the name, Rick. Where are you working?
It's called Marie's Hideaway in Stone Lake, Wisconsin. It's a nice Italian restaurant. They do a lot of business in summer.
Rick, thanks so much. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
And, you can drop by down here with the rigatoni sometime, too. I'd appreciate that, Rick. You know, Steph, I mean, that... we haven't talked much, just the cultural power of the noodles. There's something comforting that I think is a great way to entertain people and win people over, apparently.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I think, like, when you invite someone into your home and you serve them noodles, it's kind of like saying, like, hey, like, you're like, a really good friend. You're, like, my family, because, like, noodles, like, kind of have that kind of casual vibe. So I think it just says to someone, like, let's relax and eat noodles together.
And Mike, that was a stuffed pasta. Now, you talk about the definition of noodles in the book. Is stuffed pasta still a noodle? Is a dumpling still a noodle? Where do we draw those lines?
Well, that is actually about the line that we kind of came up with. Like, we're like, yes, you know, stuffed pasta is a noodle because pasta is a noodle. And, you know, what's ravioli or even rigatoni, right, if it's not a noodle? And then we got into, like, dumplings like gyoza and, like, you know, like Chinese pot stickers. And we're like, yeah, it's still a noodle. And, you know, at the end of the day, we didn't really know what to say except that you know a noodle when you see it.
Thanks again for that call, Rick, and congratulations. We'll go to Wyatt now in Whitewater. Wyatt, hello.
Hi. I was just – so some of my favorite meals, like comfort meals, have always been like linguine aglio olio and spaghetti cacio e pepe. And I was wondering if you had any other ideas for these meals that are really simple as far as the ingredients go, but kind of elevate all of the, like, few ingredients that they use.
And Wyatt, my Italian isn't so hot. Is alla olio, that means with garlic? Do I have that right?
Yeah, sorry, that's garlic and oil.
Nailed it. Ha! Wyatt, thank you so much for sharing that. So yeah, great, let's throw that one at Stephanie. Great kind of simple recipes like that that really bring out the flavor.
Well, you can always riff on those ones. Like alla olio, if you add like a little bit of miso paste, it'll give you some extra umami. Or if you add some more aromatics that you don't normally add, like instead of garlic, you can go with, I don't know, shallots or something like that. And like, you know, it's basically the same kind of comfort food, but elevating it even more. Or like when you even have like butter pasta, if you take the time to brown the butter, then you get like a nice nutty flavor, and brown butter pasta is actually really good. You should try it.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Stephanie Lee and Mike Lee. Their new cookbook is called That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpee. Still time for you to join this Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234 with your noodle questions or your favorites. 800-642-1234 is the number. Mike, here's one of my noodle pratfalls. What I've cooked with rice noodles, I get the timing wrong. I end up with sort of hot, watery rice mush. How do I not do that?
Well, we always say that, especially with dried pasta and dried noodles, you should trust the timing on the package. That said, we also are guilty of just, you know, pulling one out and tasting it and just trying it that way. With rice noodles, actually, I found that when it comes to getting mushy noodles, sometimes one of the secrets for us is using really rolling, like not quite as hot water as like a rolling boil. And often you get a better result that way.
All right, let's hit some of the basics here. Stephanie, rinse or not rinse when it's done cooking?
Ooh, if you're talking about rice noodles, then you probably do want to rinse them. But if we're talking about pasta, never, ever, unless you're making like a pasta salad or something. But the pasta water helps like the sauce cling to the pasta, ironically. So you never really want to rinse it, because when you're rinsing it, then you're washing all the starch off, and then the sauce just kind of slides off if you use rinsed pasta. So we're not going to rinse pasta.
Okay, but a particular wife of mine says, you got to rinse it or it's going to keep cooking and it's going to get too overcooked. What about that?
Ooh, no. Well, first off, like we suggested earlier, you got to pull the pasta a couple minutes earlier than the cook time and then finish it in the sauce. So then you won't have that problem of it overcooking because you're pulling it from the boiling water a little bit early.
All right, Mike. And then cooking the pasta, salt, lots of salt, no salt. What's the rule there?
Well, you know, everyone's heard about the salt to like the Mediterranean, but we actually say, you know, a little bit of salt, because you're going to want to use that pasta water to loosen up your sauce later. So you don't want to over season.
All right. Now I got another recipe from you actually at WPR.org/Food Friday Bolognese. See, there's my bad Italian. Bolognese with pappardelle. You could correct me on that. Stephanie, it sounds really good. I looked over the recipe. Can you tell us about this one?
Yeah, well, I really love bolognese sauce, and we actually went to Bologna so that I could taste some authentic bolognese sauce. And this recipe is actually a little bit of a riff, because technically they use ground meats, but we went with whole cuts here so that they're like braised and really, really tender. And then the secret is actually chicken livers, which many people don't know, but it adds like an extra richness, and it's just like a hint in the background, and you can't even really taste it, but it adds an earthiness to it, and it just makes you want to eat more and more and more.
And Mike, Stephanie reminded me, a lot of this book, you've literally traveled the world seeking out great pasta. Can you talk a little bit about your journeys in search of the best noodles?
Yeah, you know, we've been lucky enough in our lives to be able to work from anywhere, so we took that opportunity to just travel, you know, wherever our heart fancies, and that tends to be just pretty much anywhere that there's been good noodles. So, you know, Japan and like anywhere in Europe that serves any kind of pasta that, you know, like is famous. So Bologna, a little bit of France, Spain, that kind of thing.
And Stephanie, if someone's thinking, yeah, I'd like to plan some noodle related travel, what would be your number one destination for them to hit?
Ooh, I would have to say my favorite noodle to travel for is udon, and you have to go to Japan for udon. And I don't know if most people like really love udon the way I do, but it's really, really delicious when you have it like handmade in Japan.
Mike, if I said to you, all right, you've got one comfort noodle dish that you could, you know, have when you need it quick, what is your go-to?
Mine's got to be just a really nice simple sugo. With like, if you know, what's your definition of comfort? Because mine is going to be handmade noodles, right? So it's handmade spaghetti a la chitara and sugo.
And how about you, Stephanie?
Ooh, I don't know. I love all noodles, so that's really, really hard. But I mean, right now in this moment, I think what would hit the spot is mac and cheese.
Yeah, you've got a pretty cool, like a, what was it? I read in the book, a Gruyere. It's like a French onion soup, but it's mac and cheese. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that one. Right. That sounded cool.
Yeah, it's basically like a French onion soup. So you have like slow cooked onions that are caramelized. So they taste like sweet, but with a lot of like depth of flavor. And then you have Gruyere cheese, and it's just melty and creamy. And like the noodles are tender, and it's just so good.
That sounds fantastic. Mike, leave us with some noodle inspiration, please. What's a less well-known noodle dish you'd recommend we try to cook?
Ooh, putting me on the spot there. Yeah. I want to give this one over to Stephanie.
Oh, okay.
She can like, probably answer better.
Oh, a less known noodle dish. I don't know. No. In Spain, they have paella made with noodles.
Ooh, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah,
all right.
Well, like that gives us
a lot to think about. Mike and Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Appreciate you having us, yeah.
That's Mike and Stephanie Lee. They are the creators of the I Am a Food blog, and we talked to them about their new cookbook. It's called That Noodle Life, Soulful, Savory, Spicy, Slurpy. We have some recipes and a link to the cookbook, all at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can still share your favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Join lively conversations with information that affects your life each weekday on The Morning Show. Monday at 8, it's spring. Yay, it's allergy season. Boo. Find out how allergy season works. Get some options for relief. That's Monday morning on the Ideas Network.